miss you when I
back, everyone. For today, I'm actually joined with Josh Eisenstadt, who I think is very well versed on all the Twin Peaks scripts all across the board. And we're going to discuss Agent Desmond. But before we get into that, I'll head over the mic so he can introduce himself further.
Hi, everybody. I am Josh Eisenstadt. I think many of you probably know me if you've attended a lot of different Twin Peaks events in the past. And I'm glad to be here.
I think that it's good to start off with My Life, My Tapes, because this is actually where we first hear about the Teresa Banks murder, but the real catch is that it's all solved by Cooper. Sheriff Cable's a little different, and more importantly, no ring is referenced. To really start off, I guess it depends on when you and me read My Life, My Tapes, because I think that sets a huge tone of why we look at Desmond the way we do. I guess we can start off the differences between Cooper in My Life, My Tapes, the Teresa Banks murder versus Desmond in Fire Walk With Me.
Yeah, so a lot of those, now the interesting thing is you can see the kind of beginnings of what it eventually became, because you have there, Teresa Banks works at a diner, but there it's called the Cross River Cafe, and of course in Fire Walk With Me, it's Hap's Diner. You know, there's no Irene, Sheriff Cable, they call Chief. There's all these things that are slightly different, and Cooper's there for the autopsy, there's no Chet Desmond, and at that point, obviously, the character of Chet Desmond was not yet conceived. And that's why those differences were there. Now, it's interesting that stuff like the name Cable carry over to Fire Walk With Me. So obviously, David Lynch was aware of this part of it. Now, as to what input he had, we know from Scott Frost's interview that he talks about the asparagus thing being David Lynch's main input on My Life, My Tapes. So as to how that Cable character carried over and became what we eventually saw, that's hard to determine exactly.
The next one that's probably worth addressing is that John Thorne has a very famous theory about Desmond basically effectively not being real, and that this is basically Cooper reliving these events through like a dreamlike state. And again, this all comes down to when you and me read My Life, My Tapes versus seeing Fire Walk With Me, but do you have any thoughts on this theory in particular?
I remember when John first did that, and I remember thinking it kind of hit a splash. It was enwrapped in plastic. And I remember it really made a splash, particularly at the Twin Peaks festivals, because it was totally a new way of looking at it. And it really does dovetail with like Mulholland Drive and Lost Highway. However, it kind of got blown up in part 12 of season 3, when Albert specifically mentions Chet Desmond being, you know, one of the three agents that were then picked, along with Philip Jeffries and Gordon Cole, to be on the Blue Rose Task Force. Kind of blows up that dream theory. However, at the time, you know, I still thought Chet Desmond was likely a real character, but I found it to be an extremely intriguing theory and one that he was very well argued and well reasoned.
I would actually agree with that sentiment. I think for me, if I read My Life, My Tapes back in 1991, I think I would have been much more on board with the theory. But I think for me, by the time I read My Life, My Tapes, it was way later than any of the other Twin Peaks books. So I always looked at the stuff from definitely the Teresa Banks murder onward as Diane at the behest of Mr. C doctoring certain things like transcripts for My Life, My Tapes, stuff like the Leo Johnson autopsy in the final dossier, among other things, to basically cover Mr. C's tracks or keep the FBI from getting to Cooper or the Black Lodge and any other reasons that Mr. C would need to cover his tracks to them. So that's kind of where I had. And the things that I do think is a great theory, it's just that by the time I read My Life, My Tapes, that was just like, for me, I was just looking at it through the lens of The Return. So for me, I think of Desmond as like being very much a real person. So for me, the dream part, I like the theory, but it just never quite clicked for me.
I'd say I'm pretty similar. I really liked it. I didn't go with it as being the prevailing theory, but I thought it was really a really interesting and good reinterpretation of it, even though I never quite thought that was the case. And of course, you know, part 12 kind of confirms that one for good. But it doesn't change the fact that it was, you know, really creative and well thought.
Yeah, oh no, that's the thing, is that it was very well articulated. He made great points. It's just that I think it just depends on when My Life, My Tapes was read versus watching Fire Walk With Me. And just because, like, for me, it was years difference between the two. Yeah, that's where I stand with Desmond. But to move on to Fire Walk With Me proper, the first time we see Agent Desmond, it's actually Gordon Cole is like the first time we see a character on screen that he needs Agent Desmond for the Teresa Banks murder. But I think another one thing that actually John Thorne brought up in the at some point, certainly the Essential Wrapped in Plastic, is it shows the scene with Desmond as the prostitutes and the bus driver are being arrested. And this is a scene that I thought, like, if you ever been to like theater screenings, this is a weird range of emotions because there's people that think the scene is hilarious. And to be fair, the delivery is so like over the top with its presentation. But I always thought of the scene as being a little bit unsettling just because it's, this is a movie that's like a central point is like sexual abuse with someone who's younger. And for me, it's just the combination of the prostitutes with the children. It's just that I could never quite laugh in good faith laugh because of that. But I, because you know me, we've been to a couple of Fire Walk Me screens at least each. Did you have any thoughts about seeing it either on your own or in a theater?
Yeah, I've been to there's been so many because at the Twin Peaks festivals there was always a movie night, and often Fire Walk With Me was pretty much the go-to film, and you'd get a like you were saying, you'd get a large range of emotion. But I want to also respond to something that you said, which I think was a really good point about the theme of the sexual abuse that runs throughout there, especially with Leland and Laura in Fire Walk With Me, and that it being an interesting parallel at the first case that Chet Desmond that we see him on is literally that, where there's children literally mixed up in what's clearly a prostitution ring, and they're having to witness this. So it's kind of an interesting parallel. I think that's a really good point you made there.
Yeah, and it's something that I know John Thorne brought up in the Essential Wrapped in Plastic, but it was something that I always had a connection with that, like, I just could never really comfortably laugh because, we get the great scene of Gordon Cole misconstruing Oregon with Desmond. So that stuff is actually really funny, and this is where we start seeing Desmond. Of course, Chris Isaac has a great screen presence because I don't think he's ever really done any acting. Of course, he did Wicked Game with David Lynch directing the music video no less a year prior. So they at least had a good working relationship, but I really can't think of Chris Isaac being in a role of this caliber beforehand.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I know he did Married to the Mob, but was that before or after? I'm not sure. It might have been right around the right around there. I think it was might have been after, but it was right around that time. But it was really his first kind of it's interesting. David Lynch seems to like to cast musicians as FBI agents.
In all fairness, he does a really great job when it comes to casting musicians in his filmography. Because, of course, we have Desmond played by Chris Isaac, and then Philip Jeffries played by David Bowie. And people can say what they will about the Southern accent, but I think that Bowie, I mean, obviously he has a great presence on stage, but also a great presence in the movie. So I thought like Chris Isaac, both him and Bowie had a great presence, even though if they were briefly in the movie. But to shift to Desmond visiting, seeing Gordon Cole, meeting Sam Stanley, we have Lil's dance. And this is actually a scene I think is very interesting because it's very elaborate in terms of what the code is. But then immediately after, barring the blue rose, he explains everything to Sam Stanley. And this is the only time I've seen anything in Lynch's filmography where he explicitly explains all this stuff that I never would have ever guessed, like, if they never explained it. So did you have any thoughts on this scene or Lil's dance, or do you look as a decoding, if you will, of like Twin Peaks in any way?
In a way, it could be a commentary on that, on the way that people do decode Twin Peaks. And considering how soon this was after the series ended, it would make sense that he is doing a bit of commentary on that. But the only other time that I can think of that comes to mind, well, that was something similar, would be the Part 17 speech that Gordon Cole gives at the beginning about Chiao Dei and all of that. That is the other time where he really kind of explains quite a bit.
Strangely enough, whenever I think of this scene with Lil's dance, it actually makes me think of the very first scene with Gordon Cole in The Return, where they're talking about the congressman's dilemma, and they have all these different items on the table that are just totally arbitrary. And I thought that, if anything, that would be the commentary of like how to or how not to analyze Twin Peaks in a certain way. But I just thought that it was just so like over the top with those items in particular. In the case of Lil, it seems like you can at least understand where Desmond's coming from in terms of like how they operate and like how the Blue Rose Task Force operates, where it's very secretive because like Sam, he's very perceptive on like everything, like the thread, the different thread on her dress. He notices the blue rose. And Desmond does say like you're good. But then when Sam asks, like, I can't tell you about that. And of course, Sam's not in the Blue Rose Task Force, but I think the reason why I'm bringing this up is that I never get the sense that Desmond likes Sam. Like they have a great they have a great energy on screen, and they're like Kiefer Sutherland and Chris Isaac are I love like their kind of like low key comedy that they have, but I never get a sense that he feels anything more than just general annoyance by him.
I think, yeah, I think Chet Desmond is, I think he's surprisingly appreciates Sam a few points, like when he does mention the different color thread and he said, Gordon said, you're good. But I do agree that he is extremely annoyed by Sam a lot. I think Sam just irritates him a bit, the same way we see that he irritates Cooper in the missing pieces. And I think that's why he does the whole coffee stunt on Stanley with the what time is it, Stanley? He smiles, he gets a kick out of it. He feels a little bit bad. You can see there's a little bit of guilt hits his face, but then he's still kind of laughing too. So he's like kind of between those two, where he appreciates sort of, he does appreciate what Stanley does and that he has a good eye for detail, which is a line that was cut out in the script where he says to Stanley when he's leaving, he says, you have a good eye for, a keen eye for detail. So I think he appreciates that, but at the same time, he's annoyed by him.
It's sort of like in the next scene after they make their trip to Deer Meadow, where they're sitting in the Deer Meadow Sheriff Station. You can tell that Sam Stanley, he's like, you know, looking. He has this kind of idiosyncratic way of like deducting something. Later on, he'll say like, "Oh, I think that all this furniture, it's like it's got to cost no more than $27,000." And Desmond just has this like, "What?" Like you can kind of tell he doesn't say anything, but he just has this look that like, "Oh, do I have to put up with this?" But I will say is that I think this is a scene where I really started to like Desmond because when he is in the sheriff station, obviously Deputy Cliff is giving him a hard time, and it shows that he is definitely like you know he how truly different he is from Cooper because I can't really say how Cooper would have handled it, but I don't think he would have like grabbed someone by the nose and just like kind of digging in. But it's just like a very I like the way how he's very assertive, maybe a little too overtly assertive, but he knows how to get his way to Sheriff Cable, which is also like another great scene.
Yeah, I think that Chet Desmond is, he's harder than Cooper in a way, if you know what I mean. He has like a, he's rougher. And Cooper is more verbal, and Chet Desmond, I think, is less verbal and more visceral. One more thing about the car scene of interest, too, where they're describing Lil. That's that in the script, and this was not in the missing pieces or anything, but it was in the script, and pretty positive it was filmed. They go into more explanation about why Gordon Cole, because Stanley asked Chet Desmond, why didn't Cole just tell you these things? You know, why go through the charade of Lil? And he describes it's because Gordon Cole talks too loud, so he has a code. And this is his code. This is the way, indicating that Gordon Cole does this all the time. Which, if you are going to go, you know, I don't subscribe to the Twin Peaks is all meta theory. However, there's a little bit of it there, like with what we were talking about earlier, even particularly with Gordon Cole doing everything in code. Can be taken as, you know, David Lynch putting little codes. And of course, we go back to break the code, solve the crime. There's, you know, precedent for this, but that's what's kind of interesting about it. But that is the reason given is that Gordon Cole talks too loud. So if he's doing something top secret, people way down the block might hear him, you know?
No, I think of that scene in was it season two where Cole and Cooper need to have a scene where they're talking in private, but Sheriff Truman has to come around to tell him like we can hear every word you're saying. So yeah, no, Lil is actually a really good placeholder for lack of a better term for that. But to come back to Desmond and Sheriff Cable, there is that rivalry that's building up where Desmond he's saying that you know you're wasting the time of the federal government, and Cable has this sort of like strangely anti-authority streak of all people, and even like throws out threats like you're lucky I'm not wasting you. But luckily, even though once he does get into the office, he does have a good way of like talking and to some extent strong-arming Sheriff Cable of having the upper hand because like oh you know we close in a half hour. He says like oh we have our own clock, we'll close off. And it actually the missing piece that shows that that whole autopsy that they do. It's like at least like was like 12 like 10 12 hours. So him and Sam they're plugging away
11 hours.
oh, 11. Yeah. So they spent a long time in
4:30,
there.
we close at 5, and then Agent Desmond, it's 3:30 in the morning. Where are we going to sleep?
But yeah, once they do go in, it's actually Sam to his credit. He's the one that finds the contusion in Teresa Banks's finger.
Yeah.
And not that this has anything to do with really Desmond, but that scene is like borderline unwatchable for me because there's just the
The nail.
the ripping off the nail, you see like the little bits of skin where it's holding on, the sound it makes. No matter how many times I watch Fire Walk With Me, that's always like the most squeamish that I get. Whereas like I can not that I ever look away, but it's always just something that I just think, oh, like I just feel just very uncomfortable.
Yeah, which is, it's an interesting thing because, and it is extremely, I mean, it took me a while. I've seen Fire Walk With Me so many times now, but I remember the first times I was watching it, yeah, it made me look away too. And then I was thinking, why am I looking away? Because in the context of the movie, the character's dead. She's not feeling anything, but yet it still makes you cringe so much, which is kind of the interesting juxtaposition of that. And about what you were saying too, about Stanley noticing the contusion and all of this, that kind of goes back to what we were saying about him earlier, about that he has, even though he can get on people's nerves a lot, because he gets on Dale Cooper's nerves, seems even more than Chet Desmond. And as we also hear in the pilot with "Give this to Albert and his team, don't go to Sam." What's interesting about that with the contusion is that's why I think that Chet Desmond has a little bit of respect for Sam, even though he's annoyed by him. And I think that's where he finds Sam, valuable.
Before we get anything rolling into Haps, I guess now is a good time to talk about the letter that they find under the nail, how this pertains to Laura in the in Fire Walk With Me, and actually Runette especially in season two. Now is a good time to talk about what Agent Desmond and Sam Stanley find in this, and how it gets the ball rolling for everything at this point onward.
So this gets into a question now. If we look at with Teresa Banks, if we look at Between Two Worlds, we see that Leland says, which was written by David Lynch, the Between Two Worlds that's on the Blu-ray set that came out in 2014. And Leland in that, David Lynch is interviewing the Palmer family, and Leland says that he started seeing girls, some as young as his daughter. The implication being that there were many more before Teresa Banks that he was seeing. But Teresa Banks, as far as we know, that's the first letter. So that's the first murder that Leland committed, as far as we know. Now, I remember, I'm trying to remember, somebody asked me a question a while back saying, why do I think that Leland didn't kill more people? And the main reason would be because his priority was to possess Laura. And the more people that Leland killed, the more he risked exposure. And Bob could not let that vessel get exposed. But Teresa, he killed her because she was blackmailing him. He was going to be exposed there and then. But I think that the T, so. It seems to me that Bob is spelling his name backwards, obviously. Now, we get into an issue with that, with the missing E. Now, as to why Bob is spelling his name backwards, Cooper describes it as a signature on the demon's self-portrait. But we're never really told exactly why. I used to have a theory, but I don't really buy into it so much anymore, that it was the Leland part that wanted to expose that it was Bob. So it was Leland who was putting the letters under the fingernails in order to implicate Bob, because in a way, him being in this possessed state, he didn't want to have to keep doing these things. So it was the part of Leland that was like, please, this Bob, it's not me trying to do that. That was a theory I had for a while, as opposed to Bob triumphantly spelling his name backwards. However, we get into, well, I was mentioning the missing E. So if he's spelling the name backwards, we have an E missing, which would be a murder that would have taken place between Laura Palmer and the B under Ronette Pulaski's fingernail. So the only answer to that one would be that if he would have had more time, there would have been an E under Jacques Renault, because that's the murder that he commits between. And I would say that Leland definitely, that Bob murdered Jacques Renault, not Leland. And the reason I'm going to say that is because we see that Leland knocks Jacques out at the cabin in Fire Walk With Me, smashes him over the head with a bottle. We know from episode 7 that Jacques Renault believes it was Leo that did that. There's a deleted moment that was filmed in the cabin. The scene was filmed, but it didn't make the missing pieces or the movie. And that was where they fight over a whiskey bottle and Jacques punches Leo before he goes outside to pass out. The E would have been for Jacques Renault, but we see that Leland hears people in the hallway and he immediately leaves. He doesn't have time to do that. That would be the implication there. So that would be the missing E. So now the question would be, why do I believe Bob killed Jacques Renault and not Leland as the grieving father? And the reason is, first of all, I think that Fire Walk Me, number one, I think Fire Walk Me clearly shows us that Leland has more knowledge of what he's done than we're led to believe in the series. I think Fire Walk With Me definitely puts culpability back on Leland, where in a way, episode 16 takes a little bit of it off of him. Fire Walk With Me puts it right back there. I was also going to say that the scene in Jacques Renault's cabin is the reason why I believe that Bob is the one that killed Jacques Renault. So in the script, now there's a scene a part of the scene in the Jacques Monod's cabin that was filmed for the movie, but it got cut out of the movie and was not included in the missing pieces. And it has to do with what Jacques Monod describes in the hospital in episode 7, where he says about he's talking about Leo, and he says, "That bastard hit me with a whiskey bottle." And he says, "That's why we fought," meaning they fought over the whiskey bottle. Now, in Fire Walkman, there was a bit that was filmed where they fight over a whiskey bottle and Jacques punches Leo before he goes outside and is attacked by Leland. So Jacques, in his drugged out state, gets attacked by Leland, as we see in Fire Walk With Me. And as we learn in episode 7, Jacques believes that it was Leo that hit him with a whiskey bottle and knocked him out, which makes sense considering that he had just punched Leo, that he would believe that that's what happened. And he was so drugged out, he didn't see Leland and just assumed when he woke up, hey, that was Leo. However, when Leland might have thought he killed Jacques. And when he finds out that Jacques is alive and arrested, the Bob part is triggered and he has to eliminate Jacques Renault. And that's why I believe that it was Bob. Now, Bob also saw Leo there, but he doesn't know if Leo saw him or not. But the reason he doesn't go after Leo is he feels pretty confident that he didn't, I believe. And we know in episode 2 that Leland is following Leo in the woods. Now, people have asked me, how do you know that? Here's how we know that. Because we see in episode 2 a man with a coat on and wearing a ski mask hiding behind the tree when Bobby says, "Who's that? Is there someone with you?" to Leo. And Leo says, "Never mind." And a lot of people think that means that Leo knows there's somebody there. I don't think he does. I think Leo believes that Bobby's pulling a, "Hey, look over there," so Leo can look and Bobby could, punch him and pull something. But I think that Leland is following in that same mask that he's stalking Maddie when he beats up Jacoby. He's following Leo to see, get a sense if Leo saw him and what Leo knows.
I could be wrong, but I think that Mark Frost, I think it was before Leland was revealed to be the killer, but I think that he said that it must have been something for the near the end of season one or before season two, but that the person who was in episode two when Bobby sees him and the same person who attacked Jacoby would be the killer. And the thing is that when Jacoby wakes up, he talks about the scorched engine oil. So the whole thing with Leland perfectly checks out. But to come back to what you were saying about the about Leland's accountability, I think that I leave it tentative about if it was Leland or Bob that killed Laura or Maddie, but I do think that it was 100% Leland in Fire Walk With Me. Like that he was unquestionably the killer in that regard because he had so much to lose on a personal level. And now that you mentioned everything about Jacques Renault, I am thinking that you have a really good point that the E would have been under his fingernail. And also because it was, it was a different subject of sorts because, Teresa, Laura, and Maddie, there was a much more insidious part of Leland that was there for all those. But yeah, because, like Jacques, for as awful as he is, that the FBI wouldn't really think that the killer struck, certainly in that moment.
Yeah, it would have given it away if he would have done it too.
But yeah, I think you're onto something about like how this is like the first of many clues that we'll see in the original series. Now that we've wrapped up everything about the autopsy, we can go to the significance of Hap's Diner because I think it's really interesting is that we start off in the back room with like at least a night manager or owner, but also the fact that there's a lamp with the electricity, and also there's a what to me looks like a woodsman. It's like a dirty bearded man in a room. Obviously the electricity, that's a staple that permeates a lot of David Lynch's filmography, but there's something about the woodsman-like character that is very hard to me overlook, with a return in retrospect. Do you have any thoughts about any of this stuff before we even get to the actual diner?
Yes, I used to call that guy. It's kind of funny you say that. It was a running joke for a long time, many years ago. I used to refer to that guy as the staring man because he's sitting there on the chair and he's just kind of staring the entire time during the scene. Then if you notice when they're talking to Irene, Chet and Sam, you'll see the same guy, the woodsman slash staring man, walk back and sit in a booth in the back. At one point he moves his hand up like he's taking a sip of something, but he's just kind of sitting there. So if he is a woodsman type character, then the woodsmen are also extremely associated with electricity. So I always took the electricity to mean there's some kind of lodge connection there. And we know that Teresa Banks, obviously, there's a question of how she got the ring, but we know the mere fact that she has it, that she had lodge activity around her. So it being there at Hap's Diner makes sense. I believe Teresa got the ring from the Chalfonts because we know they were there as her neighbor. Which means they were aware, the lodge being out of space and time, of what was going to go down with Leland. And so they would have been there and they would have given Teresa the ring. that's how I think she got it. That seems to be the most logical way that that would have happened. There's not really a lot of evidence to say how she got it, but that the only evidence we have, I think, leads in that direction. As far as, I'm sorry, what was your original question?
Oh, no, it's just sort of just the general connection. So I think you're on a good roll.
Okay, and then Jack at Hap Steiner. Okay, so Jack, the person talking in the back, as we learned from the script, he's actually Irene's husband. And the idea being that they kind of took over the diner after Hap died back when the FBI visited back in the 50s the first time, that they took over. So Jack and Irene, it appears, are the owners, which makes Irene really the anti-Norma in a way, you know?
On the topic of Irene, I did mention a little back that I think that Irene is like low key the funniest character in all of Twin Peaks, which is very crazy because like every line she says is just perfect. But I think that scene with her, it's when you watch on repeat viewings, it kind of goes the way you expect. But the thing that I think is very interesting is the old man, the French woman, because there's something worth addressing about how he asked twice. I don't know if it's actually the same shot used over a second time, but yes, like, are you talking about that little girl that got murdered? But the most important part is that the French woman, she's kind of like comforting him. And it was actually Jay from Damn Fine TV. She understands French very well. And she said that the French woman says nighttime is the right time. That's something that I just think of because Laura, she says nighttime is my time later on. So I don't know if these are just vague connections I'm just kind of grasping at straws at, but there is something deliberate about a French woman saying that just because when she has a very he's very passionate about like French culture at large.
And then, of course, we have the French woman in part 12 of season 3 with Gordon Cole, also, which is an interesting connection there. And in both cases, you've got a younger French woman with an older man in both of those two cases with Gordon Cole and in Hap Steiner. I don't know if there's any connection beyond that. I thought it was worth noting the similarity there. But also, as far as nighttime goes, I think David Lynch has a thing about nighttime. And see, to me, Twin Peaks is so much about duality. Everything in Twin Peaks is duality. There's a flip side to everything. Even, you know, what I was talking to you about before we started recording about the two worlds, that everything, you know, White Lodge, Black Lodge, the good side of Laura, the bad side of Laura, there's duality to everything in Twin Peaks. And in a way, Deer Meadow is the anti-Twin Peaks. It's the shadow self of Twin Peaks in a way, where, you know, the Fat Trout Trailer Park would double for the Great Northern. The Hap's Diner would double for the Double R, where, you know, you've got Irene instead of Norma. Norma, the happy, smiling, friendly diner owner, versus Irene, you know, the surly, sarcastic, bitter diner owner. So I think that we're getting all this, the duality. So in a way, if we're going to follow that theme, Chet Desmond, I wouldn't say that he is an anti-Agent Cooper, but there's certain aspects of his personality that are, which goes back to what you were saying about the way that Dale Cooper wouldn't grab Deputy Cliff's nose like that. That would not be a Cooper thing. Cooper, even though I know it was in the original draft of the script, but still Cooper, the Cooper we know would not have probably fought Sheriff Cable. And he certainly wouldn't have fought him the way Chet Desmond did. He wouldn't have kept pummeling him like that. So I think in a way, there is an anti-Dale Cooper aspect to Chet Desmond, even though he's not, you know, obviously Mr. C's the anti-Dale Cooper, but there is an aspect of that to the character that he's rougher, he'll jump to violence quicker, but he also, the similarity would be that he has this intense concentration and intuition. Now, to go to the nighttime is the right time. David Lynch's theme of nighttime. Okay, the duality, that's where I was going. So the duality factors into night and day, which is something that is a theme throughout all of David Lynch's work. In David Lynch's work, daytime seems to always be the thing where everything that's on the surface comes out. You know, things seem happy, things seem nice. Nighttime is always dark and ominous. If you look at Blue Velvet, you know, Jeffrey's usually with Sandy, and we see the high school and the diner during the day. With the exception of when he follows the yellow man, obviously that's during the day, and Frank is the well-dressed man. But when it becomes nighttime and he goes to that apartment is when all the dark stuff happens. In The Elephant Man, John Merrick is tormented by the night porter. And there's a scene where the night porter bangs on John Merrick's window, and John Merrick slowly re repeats nighttime, knowing that he's going to get tormented at night. Laura Palmer's, you know, nighttime's her time where she goes out, but she's doing that because she's abused. You know, I mean, her abuse is what makes her act out and do these things, the fact that she's abused, and she's abused at night. So this day and night between the two of them is such a Lynchian theme that continues. And so nighttime is the right time, ties into that in a way, if that makes any sense.
I think that makes perfect sense, and I'm not sure if I'm just overanalyzing a surface level thing, but it's not long after this. Of course, we were mentioned before how Desmond he says the what time is it, Sam? and he spills the coffee on him. The thing is that Desmond says it's late, and then Sam's like it's early. And the thing is that it's one thing to have in this scene, but when they go to the Fat Trout trailer park, at least before 9:30 a.m., they say it again. So I mean, I guess you could look at it as a surface level thing where Desmond's on his own clock, and then Sam Stanley's on a more traditional clock, for lack of a better term. But I think there's something to be said about the fact that it's said twice, and also it's right after that nighttime is the right time. So was that ever something that ever occupied your mind about why they say it's late versus it's early?
I didn't think what you just said, but that's a really interesting point. And I think that's actually quite a good point that yeah, Chet Desmond does have his own clock, which is actually his line that he says to Sheriff Cable. We have our own clock, we'll lock up. You know, when he says it's 4:30, we close at 5 about the morgue. Sam Stanley, I think, is a bit more traditional, and Chet Desmond being part of the Blue Rose Task Force, that is probably one of the qualities that made him get chosen, is the fact that he does march to the beat of his own drummer, like Dale Cooper does, but in a different way. So I think there is something to be said for that.
Yeah, again, I've always kind of accept that I might be overlooking just a surface level thing, but I just think of just like the way they say a second time right before they see Carl Rod, who's also another deceptively omnipresent character. Yeah, because like the first time I saw Carl Rod, obviously he's very perturbed, like he's being woken up before the time set, and of course when we see him in the return, he's much more kindly, he's much more understanding. But yeah, like he's not having a good week because of everything having to do with the murder. But he does bring them to the trailer, and even though he's like he says that I haven't touched a goddamn thing, he does seem to relax a little bit for a brief period because he brings the coffee, and yeah, it seems like it's not 100% landing. Like no, they're being cordial, but I don't think the coffee 100% lands for them. But the thing that I think is worth addressing is that. This is when the old woman appears. Like in a, yeah, there might be a bit of a time jump, but she does appear. And what I always thought was interesting is that Carl Rod, he goes like basically blank. Desmond knows it, and I'm sure that there's a reason why they decided not to show it. But I will love to see Sam Stanley's facial expression in this scene because I feel like that could have been a good decoder of like what's going on or another facet because he's like the most ordinary man out of all the people in this room at this point. And again, this is a scene that I'm always thinking differently because this is when Carl Rod says, I've been places, I want to stay where I am. Yeah, when you look at the secret history, they make it seem like he's more of a world traveler. But in Fire Walk With Me, in this context, it seems like it's almost like an omnipresent sort of thing, especially because we heard the whooping sound from the man from another place, like right before the scene kicked off. So I know that's a bit of an information dump, but did you have any thoughts on this scene?
Oh, quite a bit. quite a bit. First, if you don't mind, I want to jump back to one little thing that we jumped past here in that scene. And that's the scene with Chet Desmond staring at Teresa Banks's photo on the refrigerator. And then I'll jump back to what you asked me. I just wanted to point this out. There's that moment where Chet Desmond is just staring at the picture of Teresa Banks. And he's staring at it, he's staring at it. And then we see, you know, the close-up on her eyes in it. There was one of the cast members that many years ago that had a theory that it told me about, that this cast member told me about, that Agent Cooper, when he has his first dream, is kind of falling in love with Laura Palmer. And I think, in a strange way, there's a strange connection between a detective and the murder victim that he's investigating. And that connection is one, I think, when, especially with a character like Dale Cooper, and I would say that Chet Desmond, even though he's harder, I think inside he's an empathetic person. And I think that there is that empathy that a detective can feel with the victim that they're investigating, and when I think can lead them to even start to get personal feelings. And I think that Chet Desmond is getting a little bit of that staring at that picture of Teresa Banks. He's seeing this person that he saw in the morgue, but now she's alive in that picture. It's hitting home. I think there's something to that moment, and it's all wordless. But when you look at his expression, he's in a strange way, and I don't mean in a sexual way, but he is falling in love with Teresa Banks, I think, in that moment. Not in a sexual way, but just in an empathetic way, if that makes any sense. And I think it's an interesting moment.
I think you're right because there's something about his facial expression where there's like that tiny bit of vulnerability. Because, he's a very, it's like we're saying, is that he's very much on his own clock. He is like a, almost like an anti-Cooper. Because, Cooper, he's someone who sleeps every night. Like, he talks about how it's like a road to temporary insanity if you don't get sleep. But then you have some like Desmond where it just seems almost unstoppable. Like there's no barrier that could really weigh him down. But so he doesn't necessarily have to stop and look at Teresa. And of course, you can argue about the ring that that's a factor, but there's something about his facial expression that's a little different. It's not just an objective sort of thing, that there's something a little more softer emerging.
It's personal. It's personal. And looking at that, it's personal. And he's, I think that, see, if I had to extrapolate, now this is based on nothing because we're not given really backstory on Chet Desmond. But from what we see, if I had to extrapolate a backstory out of it, I would say that Chet Desmond at some point in his past got hurt. And I would say maybe family, maybe a relationship, something that that affected him, that hardened him on the outside. Some tragedy, something probably happened in his past that hardened him on the outside, which is why we see this person, got him more in, but at the same time got him more in touch with his feelings and his intuition. So I think that we see a little bit of both of that, and I think he doesn't necessarily want to show people his vulnerability, the character of Chet Desmond, but in this moment when he's looking at the Teresa picture, that vulnerability comes out. And I think there's other moments where it does a little bit, but I think that he is carrying around something in his past. And that would explain psychologically why the character is where he is.
When he goes back to the sheriff station, he asks about the ring. And of course, in the missing pieces, he has to fight for it. Do you think that if he didn't have the feelings that we were mentioning for Teresa, do you think that would have motivated him to do something different? Or do you think he would have done the same thing regardless?
I think if he didn't have those feelings, he might not have been in that fight that way. And I think he might not have pummeled Cable so much, because if we go back to the scene, the little scene with, well, this post little scene where they're driving up to Deer Meadows, Stanley and Desmond. Desmond talks about, they're talking about the code, and Desmond talks about the, one hand in the fist, one hand in the pocket, meaning the local law enforcement's going to be, is hiding something, and the one hand in the fist, meaning they're going to be belligerent. So I think Chet Desmond is extremely also at this point suspicious about Sheriff Cable's involvement. So I think that empathy that he feels for Teresa mixed with his suspicion about Cable's involvement, and there are more evidence for that too, that's in the script, that Chet Desmond was suspicious of Sheriff Cable and Deputy Cliff. And that evidence is in the script. And I know for a fact this was filmed because Gary Bullock, who played Sheriff Cable, told me this many years ago, that Chet Desmond asked both of them. There's a scene when they're at the Fat Trout trailer park. And I'll have to get back to the Curious Woman because I didn't answer your question about that either. But there's a scene at the Fat Trout trailer park where after the Curious Woman comes in and leaves. So this gets into, and they have already gone places. Now, that line. And we know the Curious Woman. She appears. She's very kind of dirty, similar to the Woodsman in appearance. I think it's very safe to assume she's lodge related. We see her. The implication is she goes through the electricity wire with the number six pole. That's the implication in the edit there, is that that's what happens. And we see Carl Rodd's expression when she walks in. And Carl Rodd kind of stops. He does a double take. We can tell that Carl Rodd seems a little bit disturbed by seeing her. He kind of does a double take. He's disturbed by this. Like he recognizes that she comes from somewhere else. And the I've already gone places line, if we include the secret history in this, we learn that Carl Rodd disappeared in a similar way to Major Briggs and the Log Lady. That's, from the secret history. Taking that into account, what I believe happened to them is what I believe the same thing that happened essentially to Freddie Sykes and Andy. I think they were taken by the giant, the fireman. We know Major Briggs remembers seeing a giant owl. They were taken to the fireman's place or the White Lodge, I believe. And I believe they were shown a number of visions, which they then forgot until they remembered it. Very similar to what we see happen with Andy. Now, as to whether Andy has a tattoo somewhere, who knows? Regardless, there might have not been a need to tattoo him. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. But Andy sees a series of visions. I think Major Briggs did too. And that's why certain things come back to Major Briggs. And as far as the thing about Major Briggs talking to Gordon Cole and Cooper about his discovery of an entity, Zhao Day, that might have happened when he was at the fireman's and it came back to him at a certain point, and then he brought that up. And that would have had to have been obviously some point in episode 25 or 26 where that discussion we learn about in season 3 occurred regarding Major Briggs' discovery of Zhao Day and talking to Cole about it, because that's when Cole was in town. So I think that wherever that Carl Rodd would have been taken there and shown a series of visions also. When he was taken by the fireman, some of that, the Curious Woman, he intuitively knows or he recognizes that she's from the lodge. And that's what triggers that. And that's what triggers him saying, I've already gone places. I don't think that has to do so much with his traveling as it does his otherworldly traveling.
Yeah, the Curious Woman is some that, like, I wonder if she was a woodsman. It was actually Emily Marinelli on that Fire Walk Me panel that brought up that she'd be a fallen woodsman of sorts, almost like a guardian of Teresa Banks. It's been a while since I've heard that episode, so I forgot her exact wording, but there is something about the Curious Woman that's like, that subtly changes on each rewatch for me.
Yeah, she could be like some sort of because we know the Chalfonts were there. She could be another, lodge presence there that's almost watching Teresa in some way. And I would say that in David Lynch's thing, and it's not always, it usually is this way. The cleaner they are, they're usually more good characters. But when characters are very filthy in appearance, even Bob, they're usually, not always, but usually not good characters. Like the woodsman or the bum in Mulholland Drive, whenever there's a character covered in dirt. Or even Mr. C has a very dirty appearance. He always looks very dirty, like there's dirt on him almost. That in David Lynch's world always seems to be more of a darker character, which would lead me to think that the Curious Woman is a darker character, also given the woodsman, obviously the woodsman sort of appearance.
Those are really great observations.
And Carl Rod says, "I've already gone places," which was not in the script. That was a line that was given on the spot. After he says that, Deputy Cliff was going to come into the trailer. And Deputy Cliff was going to have this discussion and kind of and say, I bet, and he says something to Carl Rod, like, I bet you appreciate, these guys coming in here and waking you up. And then Carl Rod starts defending Cable and Sam Stanley. And this is where we see that Carl Rod's a good guy in this scene. This scene was filmed, but it didn't make the missing pieces or Fire Walk With Me. We see that Carl Rod is really on the side of Sam and Chet here, even though he was frustrated by them at first. Then Chet Desmond asks Deputy Cliff where he was the night Teresa Banks was killed. Deputy Cliff says that he was at a party and had 50 witnesses. Then Carl Rod says, maybe if he did a little less partying, that little girl would still be alive. So considering that this scene was filmed, that also, and the fact that Chet actually asked Cliff where he was, what his alibi is, says a lot. Then they step outside and they find a Titleist golf ball, which obviously is a reference to Leland putting Teresa's body in a golf bag like he did Maddie, so he could walk out of the trailer park without getting noticed. When he finds that golf ball, Sam Stanley says to Chet Desmond, I couldn't help but notice that you suspected Deputy Cliff was the killer. Do you think he's, is that true, Agent Desmond? And he said, he's a clown, but he's no killer. And Sam says, yeah, he is like a bozo. Or no, he's a bozo, but he's no killer. And then he says, yeah, he is like a clown. And then in the scene before the fight, Deputy Cliff asks Sheriff Cable, where were you the night Teresa Banks was killed? And rather than really answering, Sheriff Cable says, flexes his muscles and says, my alibi is as strong as this band of these bands of steel. So while Deputy Cliff had an alibi, Cable doesn't. So I think this moment, which I know for 100% fact was filmed, is extremely relevant to the fight scene because he didn't even try to give an alibi. And Chet already knows from Lil that the Deer Meadow police force is hiding something. And as later we learn, they're involved in drug running with Jacques Renault, as we learn later in Fire Walk With Me. But I think that this is a really crucial point as to why Chet Desmond does that fight, because he's also suspicious of Cable. He knows he's hiding something. He might even think that he had something to do with the murder, and he wants to pummel him for it. So when they go outside, Cable wants that empathy that he doesn't wear on his sleeve, but that he has, is coming out, and the rage is coming out. But Chet Desmond is such a refined person that he doesn't show the rage. He keeps it in and then shows it through violence often.
I am so glad you brought all this up. I will get to Deputy Cliff in a little bit, but to wrap up things with Sheriff Cable, one of the things that I really like is that, of course, Sheriff Cable and Desmond, they have their interaction in Cable's office, but they have the thing where it's like, it's still funny in and of itself, but when it shows the clipping of Sheriff Cable Ben Steele, there's just something that Desmond has this kind of like disbelief of like, why is this up here? But I love what I love is the contrast that at the end of that fight scene, Desmond, he shows that he can bend steel as well. That's the difference of like why Cable lost is because Cable has to brag and act like he's a big name. But then Desmond, he's good about keeping a certain exterior like more mysterious and doesn't show his cards unless he has to. To be fair, Cable does put in some pretty good punches early on in the fight, but it's really clear that Desmond is like has the upper hand after like the first like minute or so.
And then he keeps going in a punitive way.
And I will say is that even though this scene looks a little silly in the missing pieces, I have watched the Blue Rose Cut once, which I would recommend because when you watch these scenes from the missing pieces in order, it does add a certain context. I think that fight feels a lot more organic when you see it in context with the movie. Because I know that Gary Bullock, he said on Twin Peaks Unwrapped that It just seemed weird to him that he says the we have a phone here that has a little ring to it, and then it just cuts to like no fight whatsoever. But when you watch it like in order, it's like, okay, this is what he was talking about.
See, but it would have been even more because there was other dialogue there that was filmed. Beck basically, when my family and I ran the festival in 2002 and 2003, those were the 2 years we did it. We had Gary Bullock there in 2002, and I remember I sat down with him. I showed him that scene, and he said that all of it was filmed. That's why I'm bringing this up, to say that all this was filmed, because there's more that leads into the fight. So yeah, I was working with him. I was helping out edit a demo reel for him right after that festival. So I asked him, I showed him the script, and I said, was all this filmed? And he said, yes. He remembers saying those lines. And the reason I say 2002 is it was closer to when he filmed. That's why I bring up the year, because, it was obviously going to be, the closer it is to when they filmed, the fresher it's going to be. What happens is this leads into it, and this bit was not in the missing pieces or in the movie. But after he says, we got a phone here, it's got a little ring, that's when he asked the question that I just mentioned about Jet Desmond asked Cable where he was the night Teresa was killed. That's where that happens. And then after that, Sheriff Cable says something to the effect of, where do you get off questioning a lawman this way? Cliff told me you asked him the same thing. Why don't we take this little discussion outdoors? Then he goes to go outside, and then Sam Stanley comes up to Desmond and says, Agent Desmond, when he says take it outdoors, how do you take that? And Chet says, I don't take it, Sam, I give it. And that leads into the fight outdoors, which makes the segue even clearer.
That's a really good segue. And I guess now that we've settled on the fight aspect, of course, they have the body, but Sam and Jet, they're talking. I think Sam instinctively knows he's going back to the Fat Trout Trailer Park because of the Blue Rose. And the thing that's worth mentioning, and this is why I'm glad you brought up the thing about Deputy Cliff, is that I remember last year when I was invited on for the Fire Walk Me panel for Twin Peaks Unwrapped, we actually did talk about that scene. And the thing that I brought up that I found interesting, I still find interesting on each rewatch, is that Desmond, when he goes up to Carl Rodd before he's drawn to the Chalfont trailer, he does ask about Deputy Cliff. And even more strangely enough, when Cooper visits after Desmond's disappearance, he brings up Deputy Cliff. And the thing that is so interesting is that it's not that it's bad or good that's in the movie. It's just kind of weird that Deputy Cliff's trailer is mentioned, but no one ever really follows up on it. I just thought that was interesting that that was something that both of them brought up before they're drawn to the Chalfont trailer.
It is. Well, yeah, the second time Carl Rodd brings it up to Cooper, he says, Agent Ted Desmond come by a second time, asked to see Deputy Cliff Howard's trailer over here, which I showed him. Which the mere fact that he brings that up also says that Cooper knows who Deputy Cliff is. And of course, we can assume Cooper's had dealings with Cable and Cliff also at this point. And maybe Cooper is also suspicious. I mean, I think that, Chet Desmond knows, well, Cooper also would have seen Lil. Because Sam Stanley says, did Gordon show you a woman named Lil? And Cooper says, Stanley, I'm up to speed. So I think they definitely are both extremely suspicious of Cliff and Cable.
I guess because we're mentioning the Chalfonts, we're mentioning with Desmond where he is told where Deputy Cliff's trailer is, but I believe that that's when the whooping sound from the man another place emerges, and there's a look on Desmond's face where it's something he's like drawn to this trailer. Like he, I guess by all logic, doesn't really have to, but I think there's something about the man from another place, basically like drawing him to it. And I have to say, because I don't know if I can really find another spot to say this, but I love the way the scene looks, like with the sun setting, the contrast with the light from the trailer. And of course, I mean, Angelo Badalamenti always has a great soundtrack, but just everything in that scene just comes together in a very unnerving way. Desmond, he tries to do the traditional thing of just knocking on the door. He's kind of peering in, but then he looks, and this is something that goes back to at least the grandmother, but I just can't help but think of the significance of finding the of the ring on a mound of dirt. Of course, not only that, but there's something about that fade that David Lynch picked for when he picks up the ring. I would say this about very few directors, but so, there's something about that fade that feels like it's so much more ominous about what Desmond's fate was. Any thoughts on this scene and his relationship to the Chalfonts?
Yeah, I think that now I'm also going to take something from the script here. The script talks about Chet Desmond being filled with a presence that leads him over to that trailer. And then it describes that Dale Cooper feels the same feeling that leads him over to the trailer. So David Lynch is so into intuition. And I think that because both Dale Cooper and Chet Desmond are part of the Blue Rose Task Force, they are so tuned in to that wavelength that they both feel that same feeling when they're there coming from that spot. In the case of Cooper, the trailer is gone at that point. But I think that Chet Desmond feels that. And yes, combined with the sounds and everything else, I think he feels it. Now, in the script, he sees somebody's hand appear in the window. That obviously was taken out. But what's interesting is that with the mound of dirt, now, this is something I think, I don't know if this is kind of common knowledge yet or not, but I'll point it out just in case. Teresa Banks was murdered in the Chow Font trailer. So the fact that that's where it took place, that's multi-confirmed, including by the call sheet from the day, which says, interior Tremont Chow Font trailer, interior Chow Font trailer, pull out from TV to see Leland killing Teresa Banks. That's the description on the call sheet for the day. So I think that the fact that that's why the mound of dirt is under there, just like the mound of dirt was in the train car. And I think that's a good point about it going back to the grandmother, which is a second interesting connection to the grandmother. And this is kind of a tangent, but the creation of a tulpa is extremely similar to how the little boy grows his grandmother. He has a seed. And you remember Cooper refers to that little golden thing as a seed. Do you have the seed? So it's very similar the way it's put on the chair with the piece of hair and all of that, and then created into a person, similar to the putting the dirt over the seed. It's almost a combination of the mound of dirt and the tulpa seed, the grandmother. Interesting connection back to that. I think it has to do with their intuition being drawn over there and their connection to the Blue Rose Task Force and the Blue Rose cases in general that lead both Cooper and that give him the correct intuition to investigate that trailer.
And actually, one thing that I think is interesting is that one of my former co-hosts talked about this. I never heard anyone confirm this, whether it was like through a script or something that was during filming, but he said something about how when Desmond grabs the ring, there's gonna be effect of fire in some capacity, but then it didn't work on the day of, so they settled for the fading effect. Is that anything you can confirm on your end, whether it was in a script or a cast member told you?
I could confirm a few things about the Ring of Fire. The Ring of Fire wasn't there, but there was going to be a Ring of Fire, and they did do it on set. I'll tell you about that in a sec. But first, let me just bring up that when in the script, the way that it's supposed to work is it says when Desmond touches the ring, he disappears. That's what the script says. So he touches the ring, we were going to see him disappear, which is almost like the tulpa effect when, Diane gets, when the Diane tulpa gets shot, and when the Dougie tulpa, I guess, has a heart attack, whatever it is that kills him, and he vanishes. At Rancho Rosa, when Jade's in the shower, it seems to me like it was almost going to be a similar effect where he was going to touch the ring and disappear. But they kind of ended it with it freezing and fading out. As far as the Ring of Fire, so that was going to be in the convenience store scene. That was going to be twice. The first time they were going to do it, and they did it, and I guess they didn't think the effect turned out right. They created a Ring of Fire in the convenience store. So when Bob claps his hands, and you see it. In both, the missing pieces and the Fire Walk With Me. When he claps his hands in the missing pieces, you see like a little bit of orange reflected off of the Man from Another Place's face. That was from the Ring of Fire. So at one of the old festivals in the 90s, Michael J. Anderson stated that when they were filming the Ring of Fire scene, that they had a little red dummy of him, like a little red dummy that they were going to throw through the Ring of Fire. And that he went up to David Lynch at one point and said, "Oh, I saw that little dummy in the red suit over there." And that David Lynch made a joke and turned to him and said, "What, did you look in the mirror?" And that because they were going to literally throw that dummy through the Ring of Fire, so it looked like little Mike was jumping through the Ring of Fire with Bob. Then the Ring of Fire was going to appear again in the scene where Laura Palmer's going to bed and we go through the Tremont picture, and then we see Pierre Tremont standing in the corner and he snaps his fingers. Now you'll see that same kind of orange reflection when he snaps his fingers. That was from the Ring of Fire, which was again both times going to lead into the Red Room. So the Ring of Fire was established as being a portal that appears to the Red Room, essentially.
I guess one thing that adds credence to that, specifically with Laura's dream, is that I think of when she quote unquote wakes up after Annie disappears and she sees the ring and she's mortified by it, but you hear the sound of the fire emerging. So I'm starting to think now if that was going to be another thing that would have happened a third time. But even if it's not, there's still at least that association of like all the fire effects you were mentioning.
Yeah, because there's definitely going to be that Ring of Fire twice. I never heard anything about it being in the Chet Desmond scene, but I certainly heard it about those other two scenes.
Okay, yeah, like I said, it was something that a previous co-host said, and I figured that since he brought up about Desmond in this particular scene, that it was worth addressing. But and I know that we were talking about a little bit before, but the next time Desmond is mentioned, it's when Albert he confirms that with the front desk that Philip Jeffries was never there, and he also says in the same sentence, "News from Deer Meadow, Agent Desmond has disappeared." Now, there's a lot for Goran Cole to be rattled by, both with the disappearance of or appearance and disappearance of Philip Jeffries. But how much of that do you think was with Desmond happening to disappear roughly around the same time? Because in my mind, I think that when Desmond grabs the ring, it sets off Philip Jeffries. Like, maybe Philip Jeffries was trying to reach out to Goran Cole, but because he touched the ring, that it prompted, that was the next thing that would prompt him to go to the Philadelphia office.
Oh, I like that. That's interesting. I like that. Yeah, that's a good one. That does make sense. And that would, yeah, that would also explain the replacing. See, also, I know David Lynch sometimes gets ideas later too. That would also explain maybe why he repositioned that scene from 1989 and moved it back to be concurrent with Chet Desmond disappearing. Your theory would explain that completely as to why he made that decision, because that connects those two. Desmond touching the ring and disappearing, and this. Now, the interesting point is, why does the ring make Desmond disappear when it doesn't make anybody else disappear upon touching it? They only disappear when they wear it when they die. That's another question.
Yeah, I guess that's another thing because me and Joel Baca, we talked about the ring before recording. We were talking about how when you put on the ring, it basically sends the Black Lodge. But with this, it's a totally different because it's, I mean, it's not impossible to say he would touch the ring since it fades. But I really think it's just when he grabs it that something ominous also happens. So I don't know. It's, I feel like the laws and the rules, if you will, of the ring versus the Black Lodge, they weren't perfectly applied by that point. So that's the only thing I could really go by because, we have the symbol of the ring in season two, but we didn't have the ring up until this point, with this being the very first time we see it.
Now, I would say that his disappearance was the ring, but I also say that it's probably had something to do with the Chalfonts doing something. Now, I know there's some people that question whether they're good or bad. I'd say they're unquestionably bad. The convenience store scene with the boy, Pierre Tremont, pointing to Bob and saying "fellow victim" and all of that. I mean, I'd say they're clearly not good. I would say that the trailer disappears along with Chet Desmond, so I would think that it's more than just the ring that makes that happen. That it's some kind of magic that the little boy did, because we know he's a magician, that made Chet Desmond vanish along with the trailer. I also believe, and this is kind of relevant to that, this is the Teresa Banks stuff that we had talked about before, but I kind of have to bring it up because it's relevant to this. The night that Teresa Banks was killed, I believe a few things happened, because the question is, how did she get in the Chalfont trailer? Why was she in the Chalfont trailer? That's a whole other can of worms, but I'll just get to the point that once she's in it, we hear the sound of the arm on the television before Leland smashes it with the TV. We also notice that Teresa Banks is tied up. I don't believe it was Leland Palmer that would have tied her up, because she didn't know that Leland had any idea where she lived. She was blackmailing Leland. She wouldn't have allowed Leland to tie her up. And also, we clearly hear Leland bursting into the room. I think that that happened earlier, something to do with the Chalfonts. I won't, that's a whole other thing. I also believe that Leland smashed the TV because we hear the sound of the arm. We know the arm is associated with Mike. Clearly, he's Mike's arm. We know that Mike's main goal at this point is to stop Bob. We know that Mike followed Leland, Bob, to the train car when he was killing Laura. I think that we know the lodge spirits can travel through electricity. I think the reason we're hearing the sound of the arm is that he's coming through the electricity of the TV, and that's why Leland smashes the TV. In order to stop Mike from, or the arm who is associated with Mike, getting through. And I think that all of that might have made the next day when Chet Desmond is there, that the Chalfonts, the script says that Chet Desmond sees a hand in the window. That would probably be the Pierre Tremont, the boy, the magician. And I believe that he realizes that he isn't there, and he realizes that Desmond's under there. And when Desmond touches the ring, it allows him to do some kind of magic that makes him vanish along with the trailer. We never see Chet Desmond in the Red Room. I personally was really hoping we'd see Chet Desmond in season three myself, but unfortunately we don't. But I would say that his disappearance has something to do with that, and that by the time Mike originally, or the arm, who I believe is, pretty much Mike, possibly even the true face of Mike, by the time he is there after the trailer's already gone, and he probably likely is the one that wrote "Let's Rock" on the car, and that might have even been a message to back to the Chalfonts, even potentially.
One thing to say about the Chalfonts, I thought it was interesting that when Carl Rodd shows the missing trailer to Cooper, he says something about two Chalfonts, but he talked about his two previous tenants. So I thought it was like there's Chalfonts that they basically assume different forms on different occasions. I feel like there's like just layers of duality in that because I know duality is like a huge part for Twin Peaks and for Lynch's filmography. Because it could have just said there were two Chalfonts that lived here previously, but we said the tenant before that was the Chalfonts. That's just like an extra layer of duality that I still, that obviously in the case of Carl Rod, he just dismisses it as being weird. But the thing is that Cooper, he says it to his tape to Diane that all this gives him a strange hunch. And while it seems like he's placing more emphasis on what would happen to Laura later on, obviously he's, this is more so about the killer. But the thing is that there's still that undercurrent of Desmond, of his disappearance. And the fact that in the Secret History and the Return, where he's just kind of this unceremonious footnote, because in the Secret History, I thought it was a little weird that they do bring up that he did disappear. But I thought it was the weirder part was that apparently, Sam Stanley, he was like very like shook by this, and it kind of led to him leaving the profession, and I think even drinking issues. I don't know, and it's why I was saying before is that they never really had like a quote unquote good working relationship. It's sort of like if I worked with someone for like 2 days straight and then they disappeared, I just changed my life completely. I would have liked them to at least bring up a little more about maybe not with Desmond, because maybe the allure of him being disappeared, like it can just we can kind of come to our own interpretations. But I just thought it was really weird that there was just this cutoff point with Sam Stanley, that there would be no real emergence from him in either the Secret History or the Return.
Let me put it this way. What could have been another possibility, and this thought literally just occurred to me this second, because I've thought before that what if wouldn't it have been interesting if when Cooper goes down to what I don't, I guess Mark Frost, I think, has said before that they wrote it calling it the Elegant Building, but people always call it the Mob Zone. That area wouldn't have been interesting where we know Diane is there, as NATO. What if Chet Desmond had been there too? And then I literally just had a thought. Wouldn't have been interesting if he would have run into Chet Desmond there. Like he's not in the Red Room because we've never seen Chet in the Red Room. What if he's there instead? And then I had a second thought. What if the same way Diane is in the body of, I always called her Nido, but we hear David Lynch call her NATO, in the body of NATO. What if we did see Chet Desmond? What if another character we see is a similar scenario to that? That thought just occurred to me. I've not thought about that one before. And that could be possible. I mean, and it could be anybody because we saw it happen with Diane. We know that can happen with these lodge beings, that they can do that. And about the two Chalfont thing, let me go back to what you were saying about that, because I have a thought about that one too. I think that it's very much that the old woman, the grandson, they take over somebody else that's there, because we see it happen in season two, where there's the middle-aged Mrs. Tremond, and then the old woman and the grandson have taken over for the middle-aged Mrs. Tremond. And when they leave, the middle-aged Mrs. Tremond comes back with no memory of that. Remember when she gives Donna in episode 16, when she gives Donna the pages from Laura Palmer's diary that Harold Smith gave her, left in her mail. So the Carl Rod thing seems like it's a similar thing. There were other people living in that same trailer named Chalfont, and all of a sudden there's new tenants, the old woman and the grandson, with the same name Chalfont, like they took over for these other people that were there. Very similar to what they do in Twin Peaks with Mrs. Tremont.
There's a lot to be said about the Chalfont slash Tremonts. I just use those terms interchangeably because they just seem like they're just so closely associated. And sometimes I'll even be admit that sometimes I mix the two up, mostly because I think the Alice Tremont part being the last part in Part 18. There's always like the Chalfont slash Tremonts are always characters that I love seeing them on screen, and I always have like these little thoughts that are ever changing, but I can never quite pin down their allegiance and what they're truly going for. I think of them as more insidious, but I still can't quite articulate what their motives are.
I think that they're very, for lack of a better term, executive level lodge beings whose allegiance I think would shift to whoever is kind of if you think about it, a lot of these lodge beings, they're kind of like with Mike and Bob, they're kind of after each other for power in a way. And even with Mr. C seems to want more power than he can get. And Bob is riding along waiting for to be reunited with Judy and for Mr. C to be destroyed. Well, Mr. C thinks he's going to be the powerful one. I think there's like almost this war going on. I think that the Tremonts are kind of like out of the fray in a way. They're almost like executive level, and their allegiance is to whoever is kind of running the show in a way. But I think that part of the reason I think they're executive level is I interpret the fellow victim pointing to Bob as almost being an order to Bob.
Oh, that because I think of the hierarchy of the Black Lodge myself because there's that scene at the end of Fire Walk with Me when the Arm and Mike they're both together and they say Bob I want all my Garmin Bozia and Bob clearly doesn't want to do it like for this character who in the missing pieces said I have the fury of my own momentum it is strange like when he like out of context that he would just sacrifice the Garmin Bozia. But that there is something to be said that there is some sort of hierarchy, and I never quite have like a little diagram to kind of like indicate it, but I've always placed a more emphasis on Mike versus Bob, and then the other characters are just tangentially related, some even independent maybe.
Yeah, I would put at the very top Jowday Judy as being the top of the hierarchy for sure. As far as the Tremonts and the hierarchy with that and Mike and Bob, you got to remember, I think the thing with the Garmin Bosia scene is remembering the moment in that same scene I was talking about earlier in episode 16, where Donna gets the diary pages from the middle-aged Mrs. Tremont. And she reads it, and in Laura's entry, she says, in February 22nd, her entry, she writes, Bob is only afraid of one man, tell me once, a man named Mike. Maybe this was Mike in my dream. Even if it was only a dream, I hope he hears me. No one in the real world would believe me. So by that, that tells us that Bob is afraid of Mike. And Mike says that Bob was his familiar, meaning that that Bob essentially, when they were killing together, was under Mike. So Bob still has a fear of Mike, even though he's kind of usurped his position in a way. He has a fear of him, and that's why he feels he has to listen. And I think that the Tremonts are above all of that. They appear and they take over for people at important points, but they're not as high up as Jowday. And I think the whole thing with Alice Tremont, I mean, that gets into that's a humongous can of worms. That would be like a long explanation, but long story short, part of that I think is a taunt to Cooper because he thought he was expecting to find Sarah Palmer there. Judy possessed Sarah Palmer, and instead he doesn't. And those names, Chalfont and Tremont, even though Cooper's in a very confused state, if he thinks about it, those names are going to ring a bell.
And I guess the really only thing I can say about specifically Chris Isaac in The Return, I don't know if this is a rumor that can be confirmed in any way, but I remember hearing that Chris Isaac, he actually did want to come back for The Return, but also that he was dealing with pneumonia or a sickness at a time in 2015/2016. Was that ever anything that was ever confirmed in any way? Because I've never heard Chris Isaac outright say it, but it does seem strange because, you know, I think of like with David Bowie, for example, because he was dying, he gave his blessing to David Lynch to use Philip Jeffries. I kind of wonder if just, you know, in the case of Chris Isaac, because he was sick, that they didn't really want to replace his character. They wanted to honor that character as much as they could. And admittedly, the only way was to really do it was to bring it up with Albert and Tammy in that one scene. I know we're going a little bit behind the scenes, but I just want to hear what your thoughts were if you heard anything about if Desmond was originally supposed to have an expanded role.
Well, I've heard that exact same rumor, but aside from that, I can't really validate it for sure. I'm not sure on that front if he was or wasn't. I mean, it makes sense. I've never met Chris Isaac. I know from people that have met Chris Isaac that he has said that he would have wanted to have been in it. So I can pretty much say that's the case as to whether they wrote him in and he got sick. I don't know on that. That makes sense. I mean, because it was surprising to me that he wasn't in it. But if he got banished to non-existence, or if he is potentially like Diane and in another body, I mean, like I said, it's an interesting thought. Maybe we did see Chet Desmond, we just don't know it yet.
Yeah, I guess that's really the only way we can end it because there's so much ambiguity to Desmond. Yeah, I don't know. I think I've said everything I can about Desmond, but was there anything else we should bring up about him or the characters he was affiliated with during Fire Walk With Me?
I think we did a pretty thorough, I think we did a pretty thorough job. What do you think?
I absolutely agree. And was there any place people could find you on social media or anything you'd like to plug?
Well, I'm not much of a social media person. I have accounts. You can find me. I do use Messenger. You'll notice I don't post a lot. Maybe I'll start posting more. You know what I mean? Why not? But yeah, you can find me on Facebook, on Twitter. Twitter is at JE Dark Real, which is just JE and then Dark Real, which is the name of a film that I made and came out in 2009 with Edward Furlong, Lance Henriksen, and Tony Todd. That's why that's in the title of my email. I got that email when I was doing that film, and I just everybody knows it, so I kept it. And that's my Twitter handle. So I am on those, and you can reach me on those. You can reach me via Facebook Messenger. I check that. Yeah, and I probably will have some things to plug coming up. Yeah, I will have some stuff to plug coming up, but I will announce it when I can.
And yeah, this episode comes up late November, so I'll be sure to put it in the show notes. But you know, for now, I just want to thank you for coming on because I knew that with your knowledge on the scripts that you would be like a great candidate to discuss like Dear Meadow and the mythos of Twin Peaks surrounding it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Together, forever.